This meeting is now being recorded.
All right. Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is Karen Meyerson, and thank you, Sue. I'm delighted to be here again. I'm doing a presentation on asthma and this series of webinars on asthma and COPD. And I'm just going to go to the very first slide. There we go. So again, as Sue said, I recently joined Priority Health, but I have many years' experience in the asthma world as well as COPD, and I'm delighted to again be presenting this series of webinars. And today, the very first webinar is going to be talking about asthma diagnosis. So we're going to start there, but I want to begin first of all by giving you an overview of the prevalence of asthma and the burden of asthma. So those of you following along, we're on the very first slide now, if you're not on the webinar, after the title slide on asthma prevalence. I just want to set the stage for the burden of asthma in the United States today specifically. We know that approximately 26 million Americans have asthma. It is the most common chronic disorder in children. About 9 million children and adolescents have asthma, including my daughter. Children with asthma are much more likely to miss school, 3 times more likely to miss school than those who don't have asthma. About 10.5 million school days are missed every year, and again, we all know that if asthma is well managed, well controlled, children shouldn't be missing any school. Asthma is also the third leading cause of hospitalizations in children. In Michigan, it's one of the leading causes of preventable hospitalizations in children. And every year, asthma in children accounts for over 500,000 emergency department visits. I do hear some background sound there, so if someone could make sure their phone is on mute, please. Thank you. The annual economic costs are $56 billion, this billion with a B, and that's a direct cost in terms of obviously medical care, but there's also indirect costs, lost productivity, parents missing work because their children are ill or missing work themselves because they themselves have asthma, children missing school due to asthma. So the single largest expenditure is obviously a pharmacotherapy or medication. So again, the current prevalence rate in the United States, about 8.4% of the U.S. population has asthma. That's from the CDC. But we know that number has been creeping up pretty consistently, and it may be getting closer to 9. In some areas, it's 10% or greater. So on average, statistically, 1 out of every 10 school-aged children has asthma. If you were to walk into any classroom in the United States, a class A classroom of 30 children, statistically, 3 of those children would have asthma, and that's just unbelievable when you think about the growing number of asthma. And we know that that's the current prevalence rate, 8.4%. It's higher than that in Michigan. We know that it's definitely higher than 8.4, maybe hovering closer to 9, 10% here. But in selected pockets of the United States, the prevalence is far higher than that. I've done a lot of speaking around the country. I try to get the local prevalence when I speak in different communities. Just as an example, I spoke in Chicago a couple of years ago, and in the city of Chicago, in children of Puerto Rican descent, instead of 8.4, 9, 10%, the prevalence rate in children is 33%. So 33% of the children of Puerto Rican descent in the city of Chicago have asthma, 1 out of 3. In Harlem, in New York, African-American children who live in Harlem, there's a 25% prevalence rate. So tremendous disparities, tremendous ethnic disparities, geographic disparities. It really is almost mind-boggling. So we see a much higher prevalence among poor minority populations, and we know that prevalence is increasing. The number of people with asthma in the U.S. Grew by 15% in just the last decade. The greatest rise that we are seeing is among black children, almost a 50% increase in just 8 years, from 2001 to 2009. It's estimated that if these numbers continue, this trajectory continues, worldwide, the people worldwide with asthma will grow by more than 100 million in just 9 years. So we really are seeing asthma in epidemic proportion. I don't use that term loosely, but we are seeing an epidemic of asthma, and no one really has a good explanation of why that's happening. In the U.S., we're seeing around 3,000 to 4,000 deaths every year in the U.S. The most tragic part about that statistic is virtually every asthma death is a preventable death. We shouldn't be seeing anyone die from asthma today in 2016 with the national guidelines we have for management and diagnosis, with the very highly effective medications we have to treat asthma. no one should die from asthma, and yet we're still seeing asthma deaths. And every day in the United States, nine people are dying from asthma, every single day in the U.S. So we are around noon right now on the eastern coast, on the east coast, eastern time zone, and we probably have seen 4 to 5 asthma deaths already today from asthma in the U.S., somewhere in the United States, statistically. Just tragic statistics. In Michigan, we're also seeing the asthma deaths occur here. About 130 to 150 deaths every year of those, 10 to 15 statistically, are children. So we are, still have children dying from asthma in our state. In Michigan, about 250,000 children, over 500,000 adults currently have asthma. Over 50% of the Michigan adults with asthma had an asthma attack in the last year. Again, not well controlled. 20% of Michigan adults with asthma are experiencing asthma symptoms every day. And the hospitalization rates for asthma are the highest in the very young children, 0 to 4. The hospitalization rates for blacks are 4 times the rates for whites. So significant ethnic disparities here in Michigan as well. There have been some responses mounted, both state, nationally, locally. Locally, we have the Asthma Coalition, the Asthma Network of West Michigan, that helps provide home-based case management for individuals with poorly controlled asthma. Many of you may have referred to the Asthma Network if you are in the West Michigan area. But otherwise, the Asthma Initiative of Michigan is the statewide response to the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services. And there is a coalition consortium. So there are about 10 coalitions who have formed the Michigan Consortium of Asthma Coalitions. There's a very, very helpful website. It's called getasthmahelp.org. It's a state website for asthma. It's helpful for patients and providers and clinicians alike. It'll provide you the latest information about asthma. That's where you can go to find out what the local statistics look like in your area. But it's a great website. You can actually even look at county by county and look at the differences in statistics there. The U.S. EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, typically will host either a national asthma forum or a regional forum. They've also created a website of asthma programs called the asthmacommunitynetwork.org, and you can log on there. There are hundreds of asthma programs that have actually uploaded their information there. So if you're living in an area of Michigan and want to know what are the local asthma resources here in my neck of the woods, you can log on there and see if there's an asthma coalition, if there's an asthma program going on. If there is, they very likely will have uploaded their information. It's a repository of asthma programs, and you can see what might be available to you or your patients or your members in your area. There's also the National Asthma Educator Certification Board, the NAECB, and I sit on that board and we write the exam for people who wish to become certified asthma educators, or AECs, just like the certified diabetes educators. Currently, there are about 200 certified asthma educators in Michigan, about 3,500 in the nation, and you can log on to naecb.org to find a certified asthma educator in your area, or if you have an interest in becoming a certified asthma educator yourself. So we'll begin with a definition of asthma, and asthma is defined as a chronic inflammatory disease of the airways. So it's chronic, lifelong, inflammatory disease of the airways. It's characterized by recurrent episodes of wheezing, as well as shortness of breath and chest tightness or pain and coughing. Those are the hallmark symptoms or signs of asthma. With asthma, airflow limitation is at least partially reversible. That's what differentiates it somewhat from COPD, certainly, which is irreversible. The airways themselves are hyper-responsive or super-sensitive, and they'll react to a variety of triggers or stimuli. So I have asthma. My daughter has asthma. Our airways are going to be different from those of you on the call who don't have asthma. They don't look different. If you were to put a camera in our airways, they don't look different, but they are different in that they're very sensitive. And I'm going to react to things in the environment, even benign things like cold air, that simply wouldn't bother the rest of you. And we'll talk about that in much more depth in our triggers webinar. So in response to a trigger, like for example, cold air is a trigger for me, certainly not this time of year, but in the wintertime, if I'm walking outdoors, even for short periods of time, cold air is a known airway irritant. And that will trigger, in someone who is susceptible, that airway inflammation. It also triggers bronchial smooth muscle constriction or bronchospasm. It also triggers increased mucus production. And ultimately, as a result of these responses, the airways themselves become very narrow, and breathing ultimately becomes difficult. So if I were giving, I always say, if I were giving this talk 40 years ago, I'd be a lot younger. But also, I'd be talking about asthma in terms of bronchoconstriction. That's really all we knew about asthma in those days. And that's when Primatene Mist came on the market and the bronchodilators. And that's what people used for many, many, many years. Bronchodilators open up those airways, help them breathe, and then that was it. And they just waited for the next asthma attack or exacerbation to hit. Well, since then, just in the last even 30 years, we've realized that asthma truly is a disease of inflammation. And if you don't treat the inflammation, you cannot get asthma under control and keep it under control. It's inflammation, inflammation, inflammation. If we don't deal with the inflammation, we are not getting to the root cause of asthma, and we cannot get it under control and keep it under control. So risk factors for the development of asthma, which we'll talk about shortly, can prime someone to develop this inflammation. And when the airways are inflamed, they are more responsive to triggers in the environment. It says it primes the airways to be more sensitive to those triggers. And we'll add those triggers into the mix. That leads to aerosol limitation, and that's what leads to symptoms. So again, it's inflammation that we have. It's the root cause, and that's what we have to target. And we target that by anti-inflammatories, such as inhaled corticosteroids. We'll talk about that in our pharmacology webinar. So just looking at this, and hopefully you can see my cursor here, but the airway on the left is a normal airway, and I hope this is what my airways look like even on a daily basis, even though I have asthma. But you can see the airway lumen is open. There's lots of room for air to move in and out. You can see the alveoli, where the gas exchange is taking place, is looking very normal. You can see the bronchial muscles are relaxed. You know, I would have no trouble breathing through an airway like this. On the other hand, the airway on the right, you can see the difference here, and this can happen in a matter of minutes, but you can see the airway itself has become inflamed, and this can be as a result of a trigger exposure. I walk outdoors on a cold day. I'm exposed to someone who's been smoking around me. I'm developing early signs of a respiratory infection. That airway wall can become inflamed fairly quickly. And that inflammation also triggers a whole cascade. We can see the tightened muscles around the airways are squeezing that airway. We can see the alveoli now are getting trapped with air, and the gas exchange isn't taking place as efficiently. And imagine in children, their airways are even smaller, and they can become compromised much more quickly than adults. So this is what an airway can look like. And if you hear wheezing is simply the sound of air trying to move through these very narrowed airways. So this is just showing you a very visual effect of an airway through bronchoscopy with a camera. Looking at the airway, you can see the airway lumen is open here. This is an airway that would be very easy to breathe through. And this person was subjected to something to which they were allergic. And you can see within a matter of minutes, those airways are almost completely occluded. And look at the difference in just 10 minutes. So that is what can happen to people on a daily basis, depending on what those triggers are that they're exposed to. So again, if we're treating someone with asthma, someone, one of your members or patients are using albuterol, for example, which is a very common asthma medicine, they're using it again and again and again, what they are doing is truly treating just the tip of the iceberg. They are treating the symptoms and the symptoms alone. And obviously, they're getting relief. They're opening up those airways. They're relaxing those smooth muscle bands, but they aren't treating the tip of the bottom of the iceberg, the core, the problem that is triggering the symptoms to begin with, and that's airway inflammation. The inflammation is the root cause for all the other symptoms to occur. So airway inflammation causes those airways to be hyperresponsive. Airway inflammation leads to bronchial hyperresponsiveness, or the airways to be twitchy or super sensitive or hyperresponsive. When that happens, then the airways, in response to a trigger, will become obstructed, and that leads to the symptoms. So again, a patient using albuterol alone or overusing albuterol, even if they're using a daily control medication, they truly are treating the symptoms and the tip of the iceberg, and until you get the airway inflammation under control, you can't get asthma under control. So how can we determine who might be at risk for developing asthma? Well, there are factors that can predict someone who might go on to develop asthma. So certainly a family history is very strong, more on the mother's than the father's side. I have asthma. My daughter developed asthma. She was actually diagnosed before I was, and then she has was diagnosed at the age of 3, and I was diagnosed as an adult. And there's a history of atopy or that allergic response. If they've had positive skin prick tests, if a baby has eczema, sometimes that will set in motion that allergic cascade. If they have a history of allergic rhinitis, have they had allergic exposure? Have they developed an allergy or sensitivity to dust mites or pets or animals? Have they ever had RSV? The RSV is a respiratory syncytial virus, and we know that many babies will develop RSV, but in those babies who have that genetic predisposition to asthma, sometimes when they develop RSV, that turns on the asthma switch, and they develop asthma after that point. We see more asthma in boys than in girls, and then it equilibrates somewhat in adolescence, and in adults, we see more asthma in women than in men. Have they been exposed to smoking? Either passively or do they themselves begin actively smoking as an adult? But the strongest predictor for wheezing that actually will develop into asthma is that history of atopy of that allergic response. So we are looking specifically for certain symptoms that will help us clue into whether or not this patient might have asthma or be developing asthma. We're looking for things such as cough, wheezing, shortness of breath, nocturnal symptoms. Asthma is almost always worse at night, so someone who is having these symptoms, if they seem to be worse at night or primarily at night, is activity affected? Do they only have these symptoms with activity? Sometimes cough is the only symptom you'll see. Not everyone with asthma wheezes. Sometimes cough is the predominant symptom. It's just that cough, 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 cough. And if we see someone with a chronic cough, that might be one of the things at the top of the list. Maybe a differential diagnosis. Is this indeed asthma? Just as an example, in the allergy office where I worked, there was a woman who came in with a history of a chronic cough, 20-year history of a cough, and she had been checked for reflux and other differential diagnoses, and no one ever looked for asthma. Spirometry was done. She certainly had a spirometry response that was consistent with asthma. She was put on asthma medications, and the cough went away. So her only symptom was cough, and yet it was missed for many, many years, and she had this chronic cough. Coughing may be the only symptom present. Not everyone with asthma wheezes or will ever wheeze. So we want to do, obviously, a thorough medical history, a physical exam, measure lung function. That's the gold standard. I'll be talking about that a little bit later. Peak flow is not as much indicated anymore if you don't have access to lung function. You know, it could be a substitute, but it really is kind of a poor substitute for spirometry. Spirometry is the gold standard. We want to evaluate for allergic status, and certainly there could be some alternative diagnoses we're going to look at as well. Could be bronchiolitis, could be cystic fibrosis, could be reflux, could be a foreign body aspiration in children. But, you know, a lot of coughing truly is asthma. Let's at least look at that first, and we can rule it in or rule it out. So, medical history. We're going to be looking for repeated history of coughing, wheezing, chest tightness. Have they had repeated diagnoses of something like reactive airways disease, which is really seen as a euphemism for asthma? You know, reactive airways disease, if you code it, it's going to be coded as asthma. Have they been told they have allergic bronchitis or wheezy bronchitis? Again, those are euphemisms for asthma. When I sat on the pediatric asthma mortality review panel, there was a young woman, a 13-year-old, who died from asthma. We had access to her records, to her medical records, and her next of kin interviews and her autopsy reports. And she had been seen in the emergency department multiple times in the year prior to death. She did not have a primary care provider. And every time she was discharged, they called it wheezy bronchitis. They put her on oral steroids, and she was sent home. And a couple weeks after her last ED admission, again called it wheezy bronchitis, put her on oral steroids and sent home, and within a couple weeks she had died. And on autopsy, they found that she indeed had chronic asthma, and she had chronic inflammatory changes in her airways. She had asthma, had never been diagnosed. They called it everything but she died from asthma, had never been diagnosed. And that's an extreme example. But many people are out there with, you know, allergic bronchitis, wheezy bronchitis, reactive airways disease. The problem with that is if it's not called asthma, it may not be treated appropriately. It may not be treated according to the asthma guidelines, and that would be on daily maintenance medicine if indicated. So our symptoms worsen by viral infections, by smoke, by allergens, by exercise, by weather. These are traditional asthma triggers that we look for. And we'll talk more about that in the triggers webinar. But if they're worsened by traditional asthma triggers, let's think about the possibility of asthma. Do symptoms, as I mentioned, occur, or do they worsen at night? Is there evidence of reversible airflow limitation through spirometry? Again, wheezing may or may not be present, so let's not look at that as the only key here. Looking at all these things put together to see if it may be cluing us into an asthma diagnosis. So again, looking for history of cough, especially after exertion, especially with breathing cold air or at night or with a cold, a virus. Is there wheezing? Is there noisy breathing? Is there that whistling sound, that tightness? Is there dyspnea? Especially if it's intermittent or variable. Is it with exertion? Is it at night? You know, and I hear this from parents sometimes. They'll say, well, yes, she seems out of breath, but I think she's just out of shape. Well, you know, there certainly is an issue with obesity in these days, but if the exertion is occurring after exertion, if there's coughing sometimes associated with it, if they seem more out of breath than others their age, you know, with the same activity, let's think about the possibility of asthma. So let's at least use these clues to maybe think about the possibility of an asthma diagnosis. Physical exam. Someone coming in, we might or might not see them coughing or wheezing. We might see for prolonged forced expiration. They might be using accessory muscles, we might see retractions. We might not see this unless they're having an acute exacerbation. You might not be seeing them during an acute exacerbation. If we do a chest x-ray, you might see hyperexpansion of the chest. We might see other signs of allergic disease like atopic dermatitis or eczema, allergic rhinitis, or nasal complaints. But physical exam of the chest might be perfectly normal, and you can still diagnose asthma based on history and based on objective measurements such as spirometry. You may not see them in an active exacerbation. Just because they're not wheezing when you're seeing them, or just because they don't have any symptoms, if they're giving you a history that could clue you into asthma, let's at least think about the possibility and dive a little deeper, because they could be seeing you in between exacerbations when they're feeling perfectly fine. And you can still make that diagnosis. Spirometry is the gold standard for diagnosing asthma, according to the national guidelines. There are national guidelines that have been set forth by the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute. And the most current version is from August of 2007. They are working on selected updates. But there's also global guidelines. It's called GINA, Global Initiative for Asthma, G-I-N-A. So if you're looking for more updated guidelines, there are global guidelines that you can go to GINA. I think it's GINAasthma.org. And they have come out with guidelines in 2016. Now, these are the global guidelines. So what you'll see with the global guidelines is they might do things a little bit differently with pharmacology in Europe that has not passed the FDA here. So you have to take that with a grain of salt. But they do have updated guidelines there as well. But the guidelines tell us that, and global guidelines, the U.S. guidelines, all the guidelines tell us that spirometry is the gold standard for measuring the severity of asthma and for diagnosing asthma as well. So if you are not currently doing spirometry in your practices, I encourage you to look into that because it really is a standard of care. And spirometry, we're looking at, sometimes people say, well, you know, when you get these printouts from spirometry, they're overwhelming. We don't know what to really zero in on, what is the most helpful for diagnosing and managing asthma long term. We're really looking just you can certainly look at the whole printout, but if you key into these four measurements specifically, will be the most helpful to you. So the first one is the FEV1. That's the forced expiratory volume in 1 second. So it's when you take in this deep breath and you blow out quickly, fast, forcefully, the first breath out in that first second is going to tell you a lot of information. Because if those airways are inflamed, if you remember that picture I showed you not long ago where the airway wall was inflamed, the muscle bands were tightened, there was even some air trapping in the alveoli, it's going to take you longer to get the majority of your air out. For most of us, if we're feeling well, asthma's under control, the majority of our air is going to come out that first second. So that's what we're looking at. That's really assessing the status of large airways. The FVC is the forced vital capacity. You take in that big breath, you blow out forcefully. How much air came out in that whole forceful maneuver? So the total amount forcefully exhaled. The key here is the ratio. The FEV1 over FEC, when you've taken that big breath and you blow it forcefully for as long and as hard and as fast as you can, of all that air you blew out, how much of it came out in that first second. That's the percentage that really helps differentiate between obstruction and restriction. And then the FEF 2575 really assesses the small airways, and that's where really asthma lives, in the small airways. So I'll show you that in just a minute. But when we're looking for asthma, we're looking for an asthma diagnosis, we are looking for specifically obstruction. Does spirometry validate that there's obstruction going on in those airways? And we're looking for an FEV1 of under 80% and that FEV1 over FEC ratio of less than 80%. And then we're going to give somebody albuterol in an office setting or in a hospital pulmonary function lab setting. And we're going to look to see if by giving them albuterol, does it reverse that obstruction? Do they get better after we give them that dose of albuterol? If that improvement is significant, and we're looking at a change of 12%, and it's actually in 200 milliliters, that is consistent with a diagnosis of asthma. It's really that simple. If we're looking in the small airways, we're looking for a change of greater than 25%. So this is just showing you a typical flow volume loop. And again, I hope you can see my cursor. But you can see this line is the exhalation loop. So someone is taking that big breath, and they blah, 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 and inspiration. And they're done. And so we're looking for that. You can see the black dots here are predicted hash marks. So that's based on population averages. We're looking for, that's what we would expect to see someone, depending on their gender, their ethnicity, their age, their height, their weight. So we would expect them to be hitting those black marks here. The red line is what someone was able to accomplish before they took a bronchodilator. And this line here is the FEV1 hash mark. So you can see they got majority of their air out before the first second here. That's the FEV1. Now, this person was given albuterol. We typically will give a little bit larger than the typical dose. So in an office setting, instead of 2 puffs, they'll get 4 puffs, and they'll get a nebulizer treatment. We will typically wait 15, 20 minutes to allow the albuterol to work to its effectiveness. And then we repeat the very same maneuver. And you can see now that person was able to blow more air out in that first second. You can see we've moved the needle here with that FEV1 hash mark. More air came out in that first second. If that difference is 12% and 200 milliliters, that would be consistent with an asthma diagnosis. So that's really what we're looking for. We're looking to see if the post is significantly improved over the pre, and that would be 12% greater and 200 milliliters greater. That would be consistent with an asthma diagnosis. So the spirometry results, the classic finding is that the baseline spirometry reveals obstruction, but not always. Sometimes baseline spirometry is perfectly normal, and you can still see significant improvement post-bronchodilator. So post-bronchodilator spirometry may reveal irreversibility. Again, you can still pursue post-bronchodilator spirometry, even if the baseline spirometry is normal. In fact, if you don't pursue post-bronchodilator spirometry with baseline spirometry normal, you could be missing a diagnosis of asthma. We usually will use 4 puffs of albuterol with a spacer for a post-bronchodilator trial. Some practices will use a nebulized treatment. That's perfectly fine. Even if all of this is perfectly normal, it doesn't exclude the possibility of asthma. You can still diagnose asthma based on history or based on physical exam, and then you can give them asthma medications and see if they improve on standard asthma medications. But getting back to spirometry for a minute, we're looking at what those exhalation loops look like. Inhalation loops, we're looking for other things, but really asthma, we're looking for the exhalation loops in particular. So what you'll see, and when I worked in the allergy office and I pulled the spirometry loops off the printer, I would look first of all at the shape of that loop before I looked at any of the numbers. Oftentimes you would see this concave shape in the loop if there was obstruction present, and it's very visible, and that gives you a key indicator that there's obstruction, and then oftentimes those numbers will validate that. But you will typically see this scooped or concave appearance to the loop, and that tells you right off the bat that there is probably some obstruction. This can be a normal looking loop here, and then a restrictive loop is a very normal shaped loop. It's just narrower in width but similar in shape. It's just a smaller loop. So again, obstructive loop is what we're looking for classically with asthma. For example, a restrictive loop just means that people are blowing out at a good rate. There's just less air to blow out. So we might be looking at a restrictive disease in someone, for example, who may be morbidly obese. They get less air out. Or if they have any kind of chest wall dysfunction, if they have arthritis, or my husband has ankylosing spondylitis and he has a restrictive loop. There's just less pliability with that airway wall, so he's going to get less air out. But his rate is perfectly fine. He can get the air out. His FEV1 is great, but there's just less air coming out because of his chest wall compliance. So really, spirometry technique is key. I always say that if you have someone doing spirometry, coaching someone, and someone is standing outside the room and that coach doesn't sound like a fool, they're probably not doing a good job, because you really want to be a coach. You want to motivate that patient to do the very best job possible. And you want them to say, okay, I want you to put this in your mouth. I want your teeth around this. I want your lips around this. I really want you to bite on this mouthpiece. I want you to take a big deep breath, put this in your mouth. I want you to blow out as long and as hard and as fast as you can, and then you're going to coach them and just blow, 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 blow. You're going to sound like a fool, but you're going to get the best effort from that patient. So it's really critical that you want to achieve the best spirometry possible. If you're not getting the best results, then why even do the spirometry? You have to get the best results. So you want them to stand or to sit upright. You don't want them to bend at the waist, and that's a very common mistake. When people are blowing off hard and forcefully, they will just instinctively bend at the waist to try to get all that air out, and when they're bending at the waist, sometimes they're collapsing some of those small airways, so it's really key to keep them upright. And sitting or standing doesn't matter, just be consistent. You want the trunk upright, you want the chin slightly elevated, you want the neck in extension. You can use nose clips or not, just be consistent. But the technique is really key. Bronchodilator studies are key also for the evidence-based spirometry to really differentiate to the obstruction and to help diagnose asthma. So a normal baseline lung function does not rule out the case of asthma. If they have perfectly normal lung function, but they have those symptoms or a history that may be consistent with asthma, just because their spirometry is normal doesn't exclude the possibility of asthma, nor does it negate the need for a post-bronchodilator study. You can still have significant improvement on bronchodilator, post-bronchodilator study, even if their lung function pre-bronchodilator is 100%. You don't know that they can't increase or improve to 120% with a bronchodilator. And you will only see that significant improvement if they have this history of asthma and they improve on the bronchodilator. So it's quite possible that your patient's flow volume loops could improve after a bronchodilator. So this is really key. Once you do spirometry, what we're looking for here is differentiating normal from restriction versus obstruction. So restriction, again, someone who has an issue with chest wall or a significant morbid obesity, you might see that restrictive pattern. Now, people can have mixed patterns, but restrictive alone, you may see that their FEV1 may be decreased or it might be normal. But what we're looking for here is that ratio is decreased because they just simply have less air to blow out. What you're seeing here is the lung function is decreased across the board, and that reimbursability would be significant if we're looking for obstruction in particular. 12% or greater, 25% or greater in the small airways. The other thing we look for is response to medications. So we're looking for here, if we suspect asthma but lung function was normal, let's pursue a medication trial. Do you want to do a trial of inhaled steroids? Let's see if that improves your symptoms. So we can consider either a 2 to 4 week trial of inhaled steroids, or possibly, if they don't want to do that, a 2 week trial of oral steroids, and then we can look for those spirometry changes at follow-up. We can still sometimes see a significant improvement in symptoms and even spirometry post a medication trial, and that would be consistent with asthma as well. If they respond to asthma medications, it's probably asthma. So once we have an asthma diagnosis, the first thing we need to do now is we need to classify asthma as how severe it is. No different from the hypertension guidelines. You don't know how to treat hypertension until you classify it. Same thing with asthma. And the way you classify asthma is by symptoms, or spirometry, lung function, and this is done typically on diagnosis. This can also be important, though, if someone is coming to you and they've had a history of diagnosis in the past, but they've never been on daily control medication. So we typically will try to classify asthma if someone is newly diagnosed, or they're naive to daily maintenance medication. That's when the classifying severity really comes into play. And that is done in three different age categories, 0 to 4, 5 to 11 years old, and then age 12 and older. So this is just the 0 to 4. These are the little ones. Obviously, these folks are too young to do spirometry in most practices. Certainly, the pediatric pulmonologists do have a way to do passive lung function tests, but for most of us, we don't. So we would diagnose asthma based on symptoms alone, or if they've been given asthma medications in the past, like albuterol, have they responded to that? What we're looking for here is daytime trouble, nighttime awakenings, if they've used albuterol, how frequently that's been, how much do these symptoms interfere with activity? And these are for the little ones. And we're looking for the difference between intermittent and persistent. So anything to the left of this line is intermittent asthma, and that is really infrequent symptoms, no nighttime awakenings, using albuterol twice or less a week, no interference with activity. That would be someone who, a young child who has asthma, but it's intermittent. We would probably start them at step one therapy, and I'll explain that in the next slide. But any child in, who we are diagnosing asthma has symptoms more than twice a week, is waking up at night at all in a month, is using albuterol more than twice a week, even minor limitations of asthma, would have at least mild persistent asthma or moderate or severe. Any child, any adult with persistent asthma would be started at least at step two or higher. And the key here, this green line is a line of demarcation. This is telling us intermittent versus persistent. Intermittent asthma is someone who just needs her albuterol on an as-needed PRN basis. Persistent asthma is someone who needs a daily control medication. We're also looking at the frequency of exacerbations. So two or more exacerbations in 6 months that require oral steroids would also indicate the need for a daily controller medicine. So you could have a young child, an infant, a toddler, who does fine in between exacerbations, but a couple times a year, a couple times within 6 months, they have a wheezing episode that's significant enough to require oral steroids. If that's happening more than twice in 6 months, that child, even though they can go months without symptoms, would be a candidate for inhaled corticosteroids because they're having significant impairment, significant risk of exacerbations and oral steroid use. So let's move on to what that stepwise approach would look like. We'll go into this in much greater depth when we talk about asthma pharmacology in another webinar. But step one, again, you can see here, intermittent asthma is just SABA, is short-acting beta agonist, which is albuterol, on a PRN basis. Quite honestly, the majority of patients in the United States probably have persistent asthma, so the majority of them would be on a daily control medication. So step two is a low-dose inhaled corticosteroid or ICS. Step three is medium dose. Step four is medium dose and another controller. Step five is high dose. Step six is high dose ICS plus controller and sometimes even oral steroids. So alternative medications are LTRA, which we'll talk about in the pharmacology webinar, is leukotriene receptor antagonist. So that would be something like Singulair or Montelukast. Cromolyn is really available only by nebulized treatment. We don't typically see that used on a daily basis just because of the convenience, and there are medications that are much more effective on a daily maintenance medication basis. But you can see, and it doesn't mean you have to start a child on step one and walk up the steps. You can start a child on step five and work your way down. It's a very fluid approach. Depends on what you're seeing them and what stage severity you're assessing them. So you can start at any stage, then you step up therapy as needed to get them under control quickly, step down therapy when they're doing well. So step up if needed and if indicated, and then we always want to step down as quickly as we can. We don't want to sacrifice loss of asthma control. Patient education, environmental control is critical at every step. And you can see here too that for these young children, 0 to 4, we're talking infants and toddlers, if they are at step three or if they require step three or higher care, you might want to consider at that point consultation with a specialist that would be an asthma, an allergist or a pulmonologist. Now, once this child comes back to see you for an asthma follow-up visit, at that point, we're really not as concerned with how severe asthma is. At this point, we really are all about control. How well controlled is your asthma? That is really the key. At this point, again, severity is mostly for helping us determine level of severity when they're newly diagnosed, if they're naive to therapy. After that, we're really going to assess level of control at every follow-up visit. And there are simply three categories of control. You're well controlled, you're not well controlled, or you're very poorly controlled. This is for all age categories across the board. For 0 to 4, you can see this is probably looking fairly familiar to you. We're looking for daytime symptoms, nighttime awakenings, how much asthma symptoms are interfering with activity, how often they're using short-acting beta agonists or albuterol use, how many exacerbations they're having per year. So again, here, instead of with the, let me just go back to severity for a minute, for severity, any one feature is enough to place them in that category. So if a child is having symptoms once a month, that throws them into the persistent category. However, with control, they have to meet all the criteria in the well-controlled category to be considered well-controlled. So they have to have infrequent daytime symptoms, infrequent nighttime symptoms, no interference with activity, infrequent albuterol use, and 0 to 1 exacerbation a year. Everything across the board. If they don't meet all of those, any one of those triggers will throw them into the not well-controlled category. So if they're doing well here, but as you can see, they're having 2 exacerbations or 3 exacerbations a year, even though they can go weeks, months between those exacerbations, that's not well controlled. And this clues us into what to do. That's at least going up one step and reevaluating them quickly to make sure they're back under control. Very poorly controlled, we may be considering oral steroids at that point. But every step of the way, we're going to be assessing, evaluating, stepping up, and stepping down. For children 5 to 11, this is the next age category. I won't go through this again in any great detail. Very similar to 0 to 4. The most significant, the worst feature will place them in that category. The key difference with the older children is now they are old enough to do spirometry. And that gives us one more indicator for asthma severity. So if everything is going well, but their spirometry is indicating that their lung function is not optimal, that would throw them into the persistent category, and that would help you determine what step to start therapy. Again, we'll cover this more in pharmacology, but for ages 5 to 11, it just opens up the pharmacology options a little bit more. There are things we can use for the older children, certainly, that we don't use for the 0 to 4. A lot more combination therapy options available in this category. Starting low-dose inhaled corticosteroids, leukotriene receptor antagonists, cromolyn, theophylline. These are alternative therapies preferred for the U.S. guidelines, for the global guidelines across the board. It's always going to be daily maintenance therapy is always going to be preferred inhaled corticosteroids. They are the most effective long-term control maintenance therapy for asthma across the board for all ages. In fact, they are so highly effective, they really should be the default. If you have a patient who has persistent asthma and they're not on an inhaled corticosteroid, the question should be, why not? Because it is the most effective. But as we go up the steps, you'll see there are options now for adding a medium dose inhaled corticosteroids or a combination here, medium dose inhaled corticosteroids plus a long-acting beta agonist, ICS and LABA. That would be combination therapy, and those would be names like Advair, Symbicort, Dulera. We'll talk about that more in pharmacology. And again, you could start at any step and step back down when they're doing well, step up if they're not under control. When this patient comes back in this age category, 5 to 11, we're still looking at the same parameters here, daytime symptoms, nighttime awakenings, interference with activity, short-acting beta agonist use. But again, we also have the ability now to look at their lung function, and that helps guide therapy as we go. Hopefully, we will see a change in therapy or that therapy is stable. And this is giving us the ability to track that by lung function. We're also going to look at how many exacerbations they've had in a year. And you will see this classification change over time. They may be well controlled when they see you. They come back 6 months later or sooner, and they may not well controlled. You can have a patient who is well controlled one day and not well controlled or even very poorly controlled the next day. So it's a very fluid approach. The level of control can change fairly quickly. I'm well controlled today. If I were to be exposed to triggers, if I were to, have someone sat down and started smoking next to me, that would throw me into that well controlled category very, very quickly. So this is a very fluid approach, But it's a snapshot in time. At that given moment in time, we're going to look at how well controlled they are, and that's what we'll talk about next, too, is the asthma control test that gives us a sense of level of control in the most recent period of time, which is the last 4 weeks. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. And I do see a couple questions are popping up, and I'm happy to answer those at the very end here. So feel free to ask any other questions in the public chat option box there. We're at the next, the final category here is children 12 years and older, and this segues right into the adult category as well. And this is the severity, again, assessing severity at new diagnosis or naive to therapy. We want to see how severe their asthma is before we assign them to a level of pharmacotherapy. So we're going to marry this level of control to the pharmacotherapy steps. The difference here is we have lung function, but we're also going to normalize that lung function based on age. So we know that, for example, an 18-year-old football player is not going to have the same lung function that a 65-year-old ex-smoker has. So we normalize that lung function as someone ages, because lung function does go into a normal decline, and this recognizes what that decline looks like. It factors that into it. But assessing severity doesn't change. We assess severity at diagnosis. They're naive to therapy. It's a starting point. Then, obviously, for 12 years and older, we have many more therapeutic options available to us. We'll talk about that more in the pharmacotherapy webinar. But you can see all kinds of options across the board. Again, we don't necessarily need to start from one and work our way up. We can start at whatever step is appropriate based on that level of severity. Step up, step down as needed. For older children and adults, we do have the option of things like the biologics. Omalizumab or Xolair had an indication age 12 and older. Now that indication was just lowered to age 6. So there are certainly things that we can add in to our pharmacology options as one gets older. And then level of control, the same thing. We're looking here, daytime trouble, nighttime awakenings, activity interference, short-acting beta agonist use, FEV1, we're looking for lung function, but we also have the ability to manage asthma based on level of control, based on validated questionnaires of control. One of those that I'll talk about in a minute is the asthma control test. And based on that score, that can tell you in a snapshot of time how well controlled their asthma has been managed in the last 4 weeks of time. So let's look at that for a minute. The first one is a childhood asthma control test, or ACT. And this has been validated down to age 4. So this is for 4 to 11. It's a very quick snapshot. It can be given to a patient in a waiting room or in the exam room. They're waiting for the provider to come in. It's 7 questions, so the child would answer the first 4, the parent or guardian, and I'll show you that in just a minute, the next 3. You can see it's all visual, so there are faces that you can see. From crying to smiling. The child would look at that. You could read the question to them, how is your asthma today? They'd identify with which face they feel like, and they would circle that, and that would give you a numeric score. So it's very easy to do. Again, it's validated down to age 4. Unfortunately, in the world of asthma, we don't have something like a hemoglobin A1C. That really tells you how well, because as I said, asthma is very fluid, it can change from day to day, but we're really looking at the overall asthma control in the last 4 weeks. That's been validated as a measurement of time for asthma control. And so I always say the asthma control test score is really the hemoglobin A1C in the world of asthma. It really tells you what asthma looks like for that patient in just the last 4 weeks. So a child, you get a numeric score here based on how they're feeling. And how is your asthma today? How much of a problem is your asthma when you run, exercise, play sports? Do you cough because of your asthma? Do you wake up at night because of your asthma? The parent or guardian would answer the next 3 questions in the last 4 weeks. How often did your child have daytime symptoms? How often did your child wheeze during the day because of asthma? And how often did your child wake up at night because of asthma? They would score this. The highest possible score here, if they had not at all, would be 27. If we go back here to level of control, a score of 20 and above is considered well-controlled asthma. So 20 and above is well-controlled asthma. But again, they also have to meet the other criteria, which they would if they scored 20 or above. And we would maintain them at the current step or consider stepping down therapy. If they were 16 to 19, not well controlled. 15 or below, very poorly controlled. So again, in just a matter of seconds, looking at that score, that clues you in to how well that asthma has been managed, perceived by that patient, and patient perception is really the key in the last 4 weeks. Now, for an older child, this is age 12 or older, this is only 5 questions, but again, it's getting at the same thing, validated to the last 4 weeks. It's scored exactly the same. The score here, the highest score is 25, but it's scored exactly the same. 20 and above is well-controlled asthma. 16 and 19 is not well-controlled asthma. 15 and below is very poorly controlled asthma. And these questions are things like, in the last 4 weeks, how much of the time did asthma keep you from getting as much done at work, school, or home? How often do you have shortness of breath? How often did your asthma keep you wake you up at night? How often have you used your albuterol, your rescue inhaler, in the last 4 weeks? How would you rate your asthma control in the last 4 weeks? Again, all fives, which give you a score of 25, but we're looking for 20 and above is well-controlled asthma. So the treatment strategies really are to gain control. Someone sometimes will ask, where do you start on that stepwise approach? Do you start with one, you work up? You really, many clinicians believe in gaining control aggressively, hitting them hard, getting them under control as quickly as possible for two reasons. Number one is, first of all, you want their asthma under control. You don't want them suffering any more than they already have. If they're coming into you with uncontrolled asthma, it can be life-threatening. You want to get asthma under control as quickly as possible. Also, if they see that getting on these medications or using the proper dosing of medications or the proper combination of medications works, they will have more buy-in into using these medications on a regular basis. So aggressive initial therapy, suppress airway inflammation, gain prompt control is absolutely key. It's all about control. Then we want to maintain control, and they need to see the clinicians on a regular basis, because that control can be lost at any time. And then we'll modify that therapy along the way, and we want to step down. You know, I saw a mom once of a young child who came in, diagnosed asthma, and a 3-year-old, very poorly controlled. He was on multiple medications, including oral steroids, and mom was in tears. And why does he need all this medicine? I just want him to stop coughing. I said, at this point, it's going to take this amount of medicine to get the asthma under control. When he does better, it doesn't mean he's always going to be on this medicine. We will wean those medicines as much as we can, as quickly as we can, without sacrificing asthma control. It doesn't mean that he'll be on these medications forever. So that takes us to, this really is a critical slide. This is what we do in terms of treating based on assessment of control. This is why assessing control is so critical. If someone comes in and they're well controlled, we can maintain them at that step. But if they truly are doing well, the guidelines tell us that someone is well controlled for at least 3 months, let's consider stepping down. My goal has always been, we want a patient on the least amount of medications to control their asthma. And most parents will tell you, I absolutely agree. I want to be on the least amount of medications. So if they're doing well, we'll often offer, let's step down medications. And if they're on a dual control medication, let's go down to one. If they're on a higher dose of medications, let's go down to a lower dose. If they're on this medication, let's change to this one. Or let's try off of this particular medication. Oftentimes, people will say yes. Sometimes they'll say, you know, I'm feeling a little uneasy. We're heading into allergy season. We're heading into football season. I don't want to rock the boat. And I'll say, you know, that's perfectly fine. We don't have to do that. We'll keep them on this for now. When they come back to see us, let's consider it at that point. That option is always open to you as long as asthma stays under control. So that's something that they need to know is available to them. If they're not well controlled, then we're going to go up at least one step, but then have them come back fairly quickly. We want to make sure that's working. And we want to consider side effects and make sure that treatment option is working. Very poorly controlled asthma, you know, this is probably someone who's going to be quite symptomatic, has been having, you know, frequent symptoms, frequent exacerbations. Probably at this point, they probably would most benefit from a course of oral steroids and also stepping up therapy, adding more medication to the regimen, adding a higher dose, whatever it takes, to aggressive therapy to get them under control as quickly as we can to suppress that inflammation. But again, we're going to have them come back fairly quickly, make sure that that's working, and we want to use the least amount of medication with a few side effects. However, the caveat here is that caution across the bottom. Before we step up therapy, there are a number of things that we need to check. And you as care managers are really on the front lines to be able to do this very effectively. Step up, before we stepping up, check adherence. Are they taking the medications as prescribed? The last thing I, as a nurse practitioner or a provider, would want to do is prescribe a higher dose or add yet another controller of a medication when someone wasn't taking the initial medication to begin with. Why would I want to add more medication when they never tried or weren't using it appropriately? So are you using the medications as prescribed? And, you know, I'll ask patients sometimes, how often are you taking this medication, this inhaled steroid? And, of course, the answer you'll usually get is every day. And what my response typically to that would be, wow, that's great. You know, a lot of people tend to forget their medication on a daily basis. How often do you think, just not last week, how many doses do you think you actually forgot to take? That opens up the door to let them know that, you know, sometimes non-adherence is normal. People forget. Or that will tell them, sometimes I've heard from a mom once, you know, I was really afraid to give her that steroid. I'm terrified of the word steroid. That was a whole other conversation I had, and we'll talk about that in pharmacology, about the steroid fear and talking to them about the difference between oral and inhaled steroids and the different safety mechanisms. So that will tell you a lot. But also, if they tell you I'm forgetting my medication, that will lead you to another conversation. How can we get you to remember to take this? Keep it in the bathroom. Brush your teeth afterwards. Or that will lead you into maybe a conversation about they're having trouble refilling their medications, or that will open up a whole other conversation that will tell you that, you know, they really are struggling with taking this medicine. So that's adherence. Are they using medications correctly? Check them. Check their technique. You know, even if you have taught them the proper technique, those skills deteriorate very quickly, so they can forget to use them. I've had patients using medications with the inhalers. You know, I always think there's a wrong way to take an inhaler. Someone has figured it out. I have seen inhalers used with caps on, upside down, squirting their ears. There was actually a patient who told me, or told one of my case managers, the doctor told me to aim towards the back of my throat. He literally took the inhaler and put it behind his neck and used it that way. So you never know. Show me how you use your inhalers. Bring all your devices in with you. Show me how you use them. So check their adherence, check their technique, and then always assess their environment. They could be using great technique. They could be taking the most effective medication every day, but they're living with smokers, they're living with cats, they're living with things they're allergic to. That will obviously trump anything that they're doing in terms of the proper care they're doing in with their medication regimen. So those are really key things to look at. And then we'll get into, obviously, triggers in the trigger from the trigger webinar. So that is really, I see we're at the 1 o'clock mark. I want to leave some time open for questions. And one more concluding slide here. Questions to ask. Ask your patient, has your asthma wakened you at night or early in the morning? Have you needed more rescue inhaler than usual? Have you needed urgent care for asthma? In my mind, one ED visit is one too many. One hospitalization is one too many. One asthma death is totally preventable. Have you had, and I don't mean that loosely, I mean we shouldn't be seeing anyone die from asthma. Those are preventable occurrences. If someone's asthma is under control, theoretically, we shouldn't see any emergency use for asthma, any hospitalizations for asthma. Are you participating in your usual desired activities? What are your triggers? And then actions to consider. Are you taking your medications? Are they taking them as prescribed? Is inhaler technique correct? Assess spirometry. See if there's been any change in the spirometric measures. Adjust those medications as needed to achieve the best control with the lowest dose needed to maintain control and not sacrifice control. And then always, always, always look at the environment. Asthma is one of the chronic diseases that is so interdependent on its environment. Asthma lives in the home, and if you have a home environment that is impacting someone's ability to manage asthma, even with the best adherence, the home environment needs to be addressed. So here's my contact information. Let me segue here into questions, and I do see one from Mary about emotional triggers. And we'll talk about that more in triggers, but yes, emotions can trigger asthma. Not that asthma is an emotional disease. When I was giving talks. For some reason, it came up in the school setting. Oftentimes, I'd have school teachers ask me, you know, a school administrator asked me, well, isn't asthma just a psychosomatic disease? No. Asthma is a very real physiologic disease. It can be worsened by stress, just like any chronic disease can be worsened by stress. But even other triggers, even laughing, because any change in that breathing rate can trigger asthma. So a laughing episode or crying episode, anything that changes that respiratory rate can trigger asthma as well. But anything, any stress can worsen asthma, just like stress can worsen any chronic disease. And we'll talk much more about asthma triggers in the trigger webinar. Any other questions at this point? I hope this was helpful to you. I know that we're nearing the end of our time, but I'm available and happy to answer any of the questions. And you have my email there, and I'm happy to answer any questions by email as well. And I can turn this back to Sue and see if she has gotten any. I see another great question from Jason about obesity, how that correlates with asthma. A great question. There definitely is some controversy about that, whether obesity leads to asthma or asthma, poorly controlled asthma, leads to obesity. And I do have some of those answers in my trigger lecture, so I won't get into that in great detail. But the short answer is that we don't know. Does that obesity lead to the development of asthma? There's actually some research in that area right now. Or does someone with asthma who has controlled asthma and not able to exercise to full capacity, is on multiple courses of oral steroids, could that lead to obesity? So, you know, I guess the best answer would be it can go both ways, but they are doing a lot of research to see whether obesity leads to the development of asthma. I think that we'll just have to stay tuned. But knowing that that's an interest, I can see if I can find more data on that before that trigger lecture and add it to my slide set. So I will do that. Thank you. Are there inflammatory reducing measures that patients can use as a preventive measure? Yes. So the inflammatory reducing measures primarily are in the form of medications. And those are the most effective ways to reduce that whole inflammatory cascade. And those would be anti-inflammatory medications, and that would be in the form of inhaled corticosteroids. And we'll talk about that a lot more in the pharmacology webinar. But yes, the inhaled corticosteroids are highly, highly effective. They just need to be used on a daily basis, and they need to be used correctly. But they are one of the reasons in the past 20 years for not the decrease in prevalence, but hopefully some of the decrease certainly in the rates of dying from asthma. We were seeing a terrible spike in asthma deaths. Even 20 years ago, that was exceeding 5,000 to 6,000 a year. That death rate, I think, has been reduced somewhat due to the much more effective asthma medications. But still haven't seen much of a reduction in the burden of asthma on a day-to-day basis, emergency department visits and hospitalizations. If someone does end up in the ED, they're going to use the heavy hitter, the heavy dose anti-inflammatories, such as the oral steroids. And they'll be getting, like, IV oral steroids at much, much, much higher doses than someone using inhaled. Any preventive measures available on the well-category trigger that don't yet need an ICS? If they don't yet need an ICS, then they would be considered a persistent category, and they would just need their albuterol on a daily basis. I'm sorry, not daily, on a PRN basis. If that albuterol use is exceeding twice in a week, or they're refilling their albuterol more than twice in a year, or they're waking up at night more than twice a month, that throws them over the threshold into persistent, and that person would need a daily controller like an ICS. So if they have asthma, but they are using albuterol infrequently, they're not waking up at night, they're refueling their albuterol once a year or twice a year at most, that would be intermittent asthma that would be considered well-controlled. Anything beyond that would be persistent asthma, and they would need to be on a daily controller. If you're asking about medications that could prevent someone's asthma from deteriorating, that has not been developed yet.
Karen, we have one other question.
Sure.
It's how much of a concern is there for metabolic impacts, such as the impacts on glucose with the diabetic patient with long-term use of the steroids?
Yes, that's a great question, and we'll talk about more about that in the pharmacology webinar. But typically, if someone is using an inhaled corticosteroid in the usual dose, we wouldn't expect to see systemic effects from inhaled corticosteroids as you would from oral steroids. Oral steroids certainly would have a significant effect on the glucose metabolism. With inhaled, it's certainly considered much safer. Inhaled corticosteroids are dosed in micrograms, whereas oral corticosteroids are dosed in milligrams. So what you're inhaling is a thousandth of a dose of what you're taking in oral form. And it really targets the lung tissue and gets broken down very quickly. And in usual doses, we wouldn't expect to see, even long-term, we wouldn't expect to see necessarily systemic effects. Again, though, we still want someone on the least amount of medicine for the least shortest amount of time. If they're doing well, we would take them off of it. The problem is if they are diabetic, or for even people non-diabetic, if they are not well controlled, they're going to be getting thrown back on oral steroids again and again and again. That's going to have a much greater impact on their diabetes management. So much, much safer to manage asthma, especially in someone who's diabetic, with inhaled corticosteroids.
Thank you. Well, just one more opportunity for folks to ask any questions. Certainly feel free to put that in the public chat. I did want to remind folks that the next webinar, which will be on the pharmacology component, is next week, Friday, the 30th, at 12 noon. So if you are interested in learning more detail around the pharmacology, I encourage you to register for that. If you are in need of continued education, just a reminder to please complete your evaluations and either send them via fax or email, and the instructions for that were sent to you. If you attended this webinar and did not register, if you heard it from word of mouth and you do want the CEs, we need you to go back and register and then also send in the evaluations. Where do we send our evaluations? Okay, so you should have that in the email with the fax number and the email instructions. If you aren't able to locate that, certainly feel free to contact us through our website. And then the other is I wanted to let folks know that we did record the webinar today. It will be available on the website. It usually takes a couple of days before we get that out there. And you can listen to the webinar and still receive the CEs, too. So if you have colleagues that you think would benefit from this, please spread the word. And then lastly, we are starting something new on our website. We're hoping to have it go live next week, where you as care managers can submit questions. And I'm sure, Karen, as you have already made yourself available, if we have questions come in through the website, we could submit those to you for response as well. Is that, I kind of put you on the spot there.
Oh, absolutely. And if there's something else, like the question on obesity, I can certainly add that to the presentation. Anything else that may not be added, I'd be happy to do that.
Great. And we'll put some of the resources out there, too, like the asthma control test and any other resources that were mentioned.
Yes.
We'll put out.
I can send you the link to the GINA guidelines as well as the asthma guidelines.
Okay, that'd be great. So, you know, some great information as we're thinking about care management. We heard really good ideas to think about who, as we think about for care management services, who are good candidates for care management, and recognizing some of the predisposing factors and thinking about as folks come in for their clinic visits, their ER, if they have continuous coughs or other upper respiratory symptoms, maybe there would be a consideration for asthma, and thinking about doing a deeper dive as care managers of identifying asthma early so we can manage that well. And then also hearing the importance of the care manager once we enlist folks with asthma in care management, the monitoring in between visits, that we can do some great catches to determine the response to treatment. And if they're not getting the treat to target, we have opportunity to go back to the providers and think about treatment intensification. Or if they're managing very well, going back to the provider to think about going down a step. Would you, anything to add to that, Karen?
No, I thought that was a great summary.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you, everyone. I don't see any other questions. Thank you for joining us, and we hope to have you join us next week. So thank you again, Karen. As always, a wonderful presentation, very informative and very helpful to the folks that are managing asthma and the care managers.
Thank you, Sue, and thank you, everyone, for participating today.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.